It's time to get your checking account to zero with free checking from PenFed. That's zero ATM fees, zero balance requirements, and zero time spent waiting for your paycheck to direct deposit because you can receive it up to 2 days early. Open your account with just $25 and see how big zero can be. Apply online today at PenFed.org/free checking. Early direct deposit eligibility may vary between pay periods and timing of payer's funding. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
To listen ad-free, visit us on Patreon at patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also get this show ad-free on Apple subscriptions. See your Apple Podcast app for more details. Anatomy of a Massacre discusses topics that might not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is strongly advised. In less than 15 minutes, postal worker Patrick Sherrill shot and killed 14 people and injured another six in Edmond, Oklahoma, on August 20th, 1986. After entering the post office, the shooter methodically went room to room, shooting everyone in his path. While people were being shot and killed, others managed to run out of the post office and survive. The shooting spree continued until the gunman turned the gun on himself, committing suicide. Immediately following the massacre, reports surfaced that the shooting was fueled by a conversation the shooter had with his supervisor the day before. But this is a fact that has been long debated. The mass shooting that took place in Edmond on August 20th, 1986, became the deadliest workplace shooting in U.S. history, and the events that day inspired the American phrase, going postal. You know what happened, now let's uncover why. This is Anatomy of a Massacre, Rockefeller Audio's newest podcast series, episode number 3, The Edmond Post Office Massacre. Anatomy of a Massacre is a true crime podcast investigating the most notorious massacres in human history. From serial killers to mass shooters to genocides, there's a new story to be told in each episode. As a one-woman show, your support helps me to conduct research and assist with production and editing costs. As a thank you for supporting the show, you'll get early ad-free access to episodes, personalized shoutouts and episodes, exclusive merchandise, bonus content, and more. To learn about how you can support Anatomy of a Massacre, please visit us at patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre or simply click the link in the show notes. Other ways to support the show include leaving a positive rating with a review or telling friends about the show. Now, let's get to the episode. This episode discusses sensitive subjects, including suicide. Suicide prevention and resources are included at the end of the episode. Oklahoma State is no stranger to large-scale massacres, ranging from the 1868 Battle of the Washita to the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. But the events that took place on August 20th, 1986, at the United States Post Office in Edmond, Oklahoma, was, at the time, the country's third largest mass murder committed by a single individual in a single incident. The FBI defines a mass shooting as any incident involving at least four people being murdered with a gun. At 6:55 a.m. on August 24, 1986, 44-year-old Oklahoma native Patrick Sherrill walked into the one-story post office building in Edmond, Oklahoma, a place just north of Oklahoma City in the state's central portion. In 1986, less than 50,000 people called Edmond, Oklahoma, their home. The Edmond Post Office building was only 5 years old and employed a little over 100 people. The people who worked at the Edmond Post Office included letter carriers, clerks, and management. That muggy August morning, Cheryl burst into the building, dressed in his blue post office uniform, carrying his mailbag over his left shoulder, and two loaded 45 caliber handguns. He also brought with him over 300 rounds of ammunition and a 22 caliber gun he personally owned. As a member of the National Guard Armory Marksmanship Team, he was able to check out additional pistols. Without speaking a word to anyone inside the post office, he pulled out one of his 45 caliber guns from the mailbag and opened fire at a few of the post office employees near the entrance. He then walked straight to the shift supervisor, Richard Esser Jr., and shot him in the chest. After that, he lowered his gun and aimed it at nearby postman Mike Rockney. Too surprised to run away, he was instantly shot and killed. After killing Esser and Rockney, Cheryl pulled out a second 45 caliber and began firing with two guns. Next to Esser and Rockney was Mike Bigler. Mike tried to escape but was shot in the back. When he hit the ground, he decided to play dead. As Mike lay on the ground, Cheryl kept walking around, shooting and saying nothing. The moment Cheryl walked away, Mike Bigler saw his opportunity to get away. As he ran out of the door, he put his hands over his head in the surrender position. He didn't want the police to think that he was the gunman. The initial gunfire sounded to some people like firecrackers. Others who saw Cheryl shouted, "He's got a gun." Everyone inside the post office either hid or tried to run out through the exits. As people tried to get away, the shooter followed them and gunned them down. Some people had been shot, managed to crawl outside to the parking lot, only to die from blood loss. When the shooting began, over 100 employees were working inside the building. Many of them had just arrived at work to sort the mail and prepare for the day's deliveries. Now, before 7 o'clock in the morning, they were being shot at by a man with three guns. Cheryl shot people hiding under their desks as he walked through the office. He shot people multiple times as they were already dead. He shot at people as they tried to escape and run away. He sought out specific employees and managers and gunned them down. He bolted the doors closed and walked to different stations, shooting as many people as possible. For the next 15 long minutes, he shot at anyone and everyone in his way. Each time he ran out of bullets, he returned to the front entrance and reloaded his guns. Each magazine had 7 shots, and it took less than a minute to reload. For 15 minutes, Cheryl systematically searched the workroom floor. When he approached a victim, he envisioned a target on the center of their chest. Almost every single time he shot, he hit the target straight on. All that remained were a few clerks and some office personnel in the front of the building. Most others had already been killed or ran out. As Cheryl walked past the remaining clerks, he shot at some and left others unharmed. According to Cheryl, not everyone deserved to die that morning. After having traveled in a circle throughout the post office, Cheryl once again found himself in the front lobby where Supervisor Esser's body was. Edmond and Oklahoma State Police arrived at the post office minutes after the shooting began. Alongside state and local police was a SWAT team. When they arrived, they encountered one employee that had been shot in the parking lot. Cheryl shot the worker before entering the building that morning. Law enforcement spent the next 45 minutes trying to communicate with the shooter, but all their attempts at communication failed. After 45 long minutes of failing to get in contact with the shooter, the Edmond SWAT team finally made their way inside the building. And when they entered, they understood the full scale of the situation.
Walk back a little ways on the right in a booth. There are three bodies. You walk back a few feet further and there are four bodies. And you go back a little bit further and there's another couple. You come back up the other side. There are isolated bodies. You go back in the back room where they're having a break. There are donuts and coffee on the table and a dead body laying there.
Within 15 minutes, Cheryl shot 20 people, killing 14 of them. Throughout the massacre, he managed to fire off more than 50 rounds. The victims that day ranged from as young as 27 years old up to 51. Among the dead was 27-year-old clerk Patty Lou Welch, 31-year-old part-time clerk Thomas Wade Shader Jr., 33-year-old letter carrier Paul Michael Rockney, 51-year-old carrier Jerry Ralph Pye, 22-year-old carrier Leroy Phillips, 49-year-old carrier Kenneth W. Moroy, 30-year-old carrier William Miller, 34-year-old clerk Betty Ann Jared, 48-year-old supervisor Patty Jean Husband, 30-year-old clerk Jonah Ruth Gregert, 47-year-old clerk Patricia Gobert, 38-year-old supervisor Richard Esser Jr., 41-year-old part-time clerk Judy Stevens Denny, and 41-year-old part-time clerk Patricia Ann Chambers. Six people were shot that day but managed to survive. They were William Nimmo, Gene Bray, Michael Bigler, Steve Vick, Judy Walker, and Joyce Ingram. The police also found the shooter, Patrick Cheryl, dead inside the post office. He was killed from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the forehead. The police tried to speak with him for 45 minutes before they entered the building, not knowing that he was already dead. The massacre became the deadliest workplace shooting in U.S. history. It was also the country's worst shooting since July 18, 1984, when 21 people, including the gunman, died at the McDonald's restaurant in San Ysidro, California. 44-year-old Patrick Cheryl was born on November 13, 1941, in a small town 60 miles northwest of Oklahoma City. He was born 3 weeks and 3 days before the U.S. entered World War II. Cheryl, his older brother and sister, grew up on a small family-owned farm. The family also owned and operated a small cafe in town. By the mid-1950s, the Cheryl family sold everything they owned and moved to Oklahoma City. The move from a small farm town to a big city like Oklahoma City was difficult on Cheryl. For the first decade of his life, he was used to living in a small town where everyone knew everyone. But when the family up and moved to Oklahoma City, he didn't know anyone besides his parents and siblings. He was a student at Harding High School in Oklahoma City, where his grades were barely passable. He was much taller than most of his classmates, and as a young teenager, he was already starting to bald. His yearbook photo betrays a young man that still had a country boy appearance. He enrolled in sports when he figured out that school books weren't exactly his thing. Throughout high school, he lettered in three different sports, and for once, he finally felt accepted. When Cheryl was only a teenager, his father passed away. His father reportedly suffered serious mental health challenges, and his sudden death was particularly difficult on Cheryl. After high school graduation in June of 1959, he enrolled in college classes at Oklahoma University on a wrestling scholarship. But his time at Oklahoma University was short-lived. Later that same year, he dropped out of college and enrolled in the Marine Corps, where he became a weapons expert. The structure of military life seemed to suit him. Although he tended to resent those who exercised authority over him. Besides the badges from firearms qualifications, Cheryl didn't earn any medals, ribbons, or awards during his time in the military. And after serving 3 years, he received a general discharge in December 1966. After leaving the military, Cheryl struggled to settle into civilian life. After failing to hold down a steady job, he enrolled at Edmond Central State University in 1967. But his time there was also limited. After receiving straight D's and F's in all of his courses, he dropped out in the spring of 1970. In the following years, Cheryl began living with his mom in a small house on Northwest 27th Street, a working-class neighborhood of Oklahoma City. Cheryl would avoid working for long periods of time by living off his mother's income. If he did have a job, he was only employed for a short time before either getting fired or quitting. In 1977, Cheryl's mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. The disease grew quickly, and she was placed in a full-time nursing home by the end of the year. And 1 year later, in 1978, she passed away. After his mother passed away, Cheryl needed to get a job. He could no longer depend on his mom's limited income. So after she was gone, Cheryl lived in his mother's house and began looking for work. He got a job as an installer and technician at a radio store. But his time there only lasted 8 months. Just a few months into the job, he quit. One afternoon, a customer walked into the radio shop and asked for some help with finding an item. A coworker of Cheryl's nodded toward Cheryl's direction and said, "The young man over there can help you." Enraged by being called a young man, Cheryl snapped, "I have a given name, and it's Patrick Cheryl." After that, he turned around, walked out of the radio store, and never came back. Later that same year, Cheryl found another job as a file clerk with the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA. Coworkers there described Cheryl as awkward and arrogant. Others described him as an odd duck and someone who was hard to talk to. He just seemed like someone who was always out of place. There were also allegations made that Cheryl was sexually harassing his female coworkers at the FAA. Although he was quiet and never showed any violent behavior at work, he made his female workers uncomfortable by constantly staring at them. Other women accused Cheryl of inappropriately rubbing up against them in the office. The FAA eventually fired Cheryl after a female coworker reported that he cornered her in an elevator and wouldn't let her go. In August 1982, Cheryl joined the U.S. Air Force Reserve. Something about the structure of military life stuck with him. It also filled significant gaps of free time in his life. Cheryl rode his bike when he wasn't required to be at meetings or trainings with the Air Force Reserve. His bicycle became his primary method of transportation. On one particular bike ride, he met Edmond USPS employee Thomas Shader. In 1985, Cheryl scored high on a United States Postal Service entrance exam and was hired on as a letter carrier for the Edmond, Oklahoma Post Office. Initially, he was hired on as a relief carrier. This meant that he was often required to work alternate routes on different days. The route in which carriers received was based on the seniority list. A higher ranking of seniority meant a more stable and routine route. Others, like Cheryl, who ranked lower on the seniority list, were given different routes almost every day. Initially, Cheryl was excited about his new job with the USPS. He woke up each morning and was proud to wear his blue uniform, and each day he showed up at the post office, he gave 100% of him. But that wasn't enough for Cheryl's supervisors. As hard as Cheryl thought that he was working, they never seemed to think that he worked half as hard. After 16 months as a part-time letter carrier, Cheryl was still receiving complaints from his supervisors about misdirected mail and tardy performance. And the conversations between Cheryl and his supervisors escalated in August 1986. On August 19th, 1986, one day before the massacre, two supervisors, Bill Bland and Richard Esser Jr., escorted Cheryl into the office. When they sat Cheryl down, they verbally reprimanded Cheryl about his work performance. The conversation ended with the two supervisors telling him they would have no choice but to fire him from the post office if his performance didn't improve. Cheryl left the office visibly shaken by the conversation. That afternoon, he got on the phone with the USPS union headquarters and requested a transfer to maintenance. He told the union representative that his supervisors were mistreating him in Edmond. But the conversation didn't go Cheryl's way. Instead, the union rep said they needed to look into his claim before any transfer would be made. Enraged, Cheryl drove home. He knew he was a better letter carrier than most of his supervisors. And if his supervisors couldn't see that, they needed to go. The following day, August 20th, 1986, Cheryl got dressed in his blue uniform like he did every morning. He placed two 45 Colt government-issued semi-automatics, a 22 caliber pistol, and a handful of ammunition in his mailbag. He then drove to work at his usual 6:45 p.m., and then the horrific massacre began. A clearer picture of Patrick Henry Cheryl emerged in the weeks and months following the mass shooting. His neighbors who lived by his mother's house sometimes referred to him as Crazy Pat because of his strange behavior. According to neighbors, Cheryl would sometimes mow his lawn at midnight or peer into neighbors' windows while wearing military combat fatigues. Other neighbors alleged Cheryl had tied neighborhood dogs up with wire. To the neighbors, Cheryl was a loner and a weird individual. According to the FBI, most mass shooters display, quote, concerning behavior before the massacre. Concerning behavior can range from odd interpersonal interactions, recklessness, impulsivity, changes in hygiene and weight, and physical aggression. In more than 50% of mass shooters studied by the FBI, the shooter experienced odd interpersonal interactions. Crazy Pat fits the description perfectly. Many people close to him described Cheryl as a loner. He never married and lived with his mom up until she died. Even after his mother passed away, Cheryl mostly kept to himself. Of mass shootings studied by the FBI, most mass shooters are single. It's also common to see antisocial behavior. At work, Cheryl's coworkers described a similar strange individual. Only a handful of the coworkers told investigators that they thought he was a nice and quiet guy. Most of them told the police that he was often angry and frequently depressed at work. He was described as a habitual complainer. Cheryl was the one coworker who no one else understood. In more than 40% of mass shooters studied and reported by the FBI, the shooter was described as an underperformer at work. Most of Cheryl's coworkers, including his supervisors, said he was lazy and often underperformed. The same can also be said about school performance. Many mass shooters struggle to obtain passing grades in school. Throughout high school and into college, Cheryl struggled with maintaining decent grades. Throughout his entire life, Cheryl had a fascination with firearms. When he enrolled in the Marine Corps in 1969, he became a weapons expert. He was qualified as an expert with an M14 rifle. But his status as an expert didn't last. When it came time for him to requalify on the rifle range, he dropped down two steps from the top qualification as expert to the lower rank of marksman. This demotion didn't seem to bother Cheryl because he had already earned an expert medal with a pistol. On the morning of the massacre, Cheryl brought two loaded 45 caliber pistols he had checked out from the National Guard Armory. As a marksmanship team member, he was allowed to take handguns with him. In most mass shootings, the weapons used to perpetrate the attack are purchased and obtained legally. The offender usually legally purchases or obtains the gun specifically to execute the attack. In only a small number of mass shootings, the gunman buys or gets the weapons illegally. And a significant amount of mass shooters already possessed a firearm before the attack. In over 70% of mass shootings, the gunman either purchased the weapon used legally or they already had the weapon in their possession. In less than 10% of cases, the gun was either stolen or borrowed. In Cheryl's case, he had years of experience using firearms. Throughout his career in the military, he was regularly exposed to guns. And all three of the guns used in the shooting were obtained legally. Two came from the military base, and the third gun was one of his own personal guns. Nearly one quarter of mass shooters studied by the FBI notes some type of military experience. Previous mass shooters have served in the Army, Marines, Navy, Air Force, and the Coast Guard. Cheryl had several years of military experience in the Marine Corps as well as the reserves. In many mass shootings, the gunman has targets. Targets are specific people or groups of people they want to kill. Sometimes the gunman doesn't know the victim's names. They can simply belong to a particular group or organization. Other times, the gunman is extremely specific and methodical about their targets. In Cheryl's case, the targets are difficult to identify. However, based on Cheryl's conversation with his two supervisors the day before the massacre, many people speculate that his supervisors were the prime targets. The two supervisors who sat down with Cheryl the day before the shooting were Bill Bland and Richard Esser Jr. But only Richard Esser Jr. was shot and killed that day. Richard Jr. was one of the first people killed. On the other hand, Bill Bland managed to survive. Bill arrived late for work that morning and wasn't in the post office when the shooting took place. Now, it's unclear if Cheryl planned to target both Richard Esser Jr. and Bill Bland that morning. The exact nature of the conversation between Cheryl and his two supervisors that day isn't clear. Some reports suggest that the conversation wasn't necessary and that the supervisors may have only brought Cheryl into the office to harass him. But other reports indicate that Cheryl was underperforming and that the conversation was made to make sure that he was made aware of his underperformance. The specific people Cheryl targeted that morning remains a mystery. As he made his way throughout the post office, he seemed to spare some people's lives while taking others. A few survivors told the authorities that he walked right past them but didn't shoot them. But not everyone was as lucky. As many people tried to get out of the building, Cheryl shot at them as they ran towards the exit. Cheryl's victims included males and females ranging in age from 27 to 51 years old. The majority of them were either postal clerks or delivery carriers. Only one of the victims was a supervisor. It's also a mystery why Cheryl didn't shoot and kill more people than he did. The 20 people he shot represented only one-fifth of the total employees normally working in the office at that time. We know that Cheryl brought three guns and a few hundred rounds of ammunition with him. When his body was discovered, the police found he still had plenty of rounds of ammo to keep shooting. And because it took the SWAT team over 45 minutes to get inside the post office, Cheryl could have had a lot more time. The average mass shooting here in the United States is between 12 and 13 minutes. The shooting in Edmond lasted for about 15 minutes, so not too far from the national average. So it's possible that after shooting 20 people, Cheryl thought he was running out of time and that the police would break in and stop him any minute. And before they could get to him, he turned the gun on himself. If Cheryl didn't stop when he did, there would likely be many, many more victims. In almost 50% of all mass shooting incidents, the gunman dies. They're either shot and killed by the police or turn the gun on themselves and commit suicide. Many mass shooters have experienced suicidal ideations before the massacre, and many of them go into these events prepared and ready to die, either suicide by cop or commit suicide themselves. It's very rare, very unusual, for a mass shooter to go into an incident and expect to escape or get away. But some shooters don't care either way. And in cases like what happened with the Parkland school shooter, they didn't commit suicide and that gunman was arrested. Now, it's unknown whether Cheryl experienced any suicidal ideation before the shooting. If he did, no one knew about it. It's not known whether he intended to commit suicide that morning. Before his death, he didn't leave behind any suicide notes or messages. So the motive behind his suicide remains a mystery, and experts can only speculate why he ended it the way he did. Many mass shooters spend months methodically planning the shooting. Mass shooters are known to research potential locations where large crowds are expected. They also save money to purchase hundreds of rounds of ammunition and guns. They research the location's floor plans to determine the best place to start shooting to kill as many people as possible. Many mass shooters methodically plan out their attacks months before it happens. It's not apparently known how much planning Cheryl did before August 20th, 1986. It's possible this was something that he had thought about doing for months. And it's also possible that the thought came the day before when he sat down with his supervisors. But without a suicide note or message, the planning that went into that morning isn't known and can only be left to speculation. Over the years, experts in law enforcement have put together a profile for workplace shooters like Cheryl. Workplace shooters are described as 40-something-year-old males without a specific racial profile. Most are employees of their targeted location, often blue-collar job sites. And many of the shooters have some grievances against the workplace. They usually legally purchase handguns and assault rifles. Patrick Cheryl fits this profile almost perfectly. He was 44 years old, a white male. He worked at the Edmond Post Office. He had grievances against his workplace, mainly his supervisors. And he purchased the three handguns legally. After three decades, we may never fully understand what motivated Patrick Cheryl on August 20th, 1986. Experts in the field of law enforcement and psychology can also speculate about possible motives. Over the years, many experts have studied Cheryl and his background. They've attempted to try and explain the massacre. They have found that he possesses many common traits with other mass shooters. Patrick Cheryl will forever be described as a disgruntled postal worker who fits the mass shooter profile. He's often described as an inept loner who couldn't hold down a job and blamed management for his problems. He never got close with anyone other than his mother, and he was always looking for ways to take the easy way out. When faced with a challenge or adversity, he often turned away. He got angry and frustrated with the situation instead of looking for ways to overcome them. He was fascinated by guns during the time he spent in the military. Frustrated at being formally disciplined by his postal supervisors, he took matters into his own hands. He armed himself with 3 semi-automatic pistols and hundreds of rounds of ammunition before entering the post office. After 15 long minutes of shooting, the massacre was over. His actions killed 14 of his coworkers and injured another 6. He then turned the gun on himself and committed suicide. On May 29, 1989, a yellow ribbon memorial was built to dedicate to the victims. The outdoor statue is located outside the post office's main entryway. The memorial depicts a man and a woman standing on a fountain holding a yellow ribbon. The fountain has 14 water jets and a plaque with their names to honor the 14 people killed that day. The Edmond Post Office Massacre helped to give rise to the term going postal. Going postal is a phrase used to describe someone who gets extremely angry in a workplace environment, often to the point of violence. Although the term going postal didn't directly come from Edmond, it grew in popularity through the series of shootings at post offices from the early 1970s through today. Between 1970 and 1997, more than 40 people were killed by then current or former employees in at least 20 workplace incidents. Between 1986 and 2022, workplace shootings happened roughly twice a year. The most notable workplace postal shootings include the Los Angeles 1970 incident, where a 41-year-old man shot and killed his postal supervisor. In 1989, an Escondido, California postal worker shot and killed his wife, drove to the Orange Glen post office, and killed 2 coworkers. In 1991, a former U.S. postal worker killed his supervisor. The next day, he shot and killed 2 mail handlers. Later that year, a man in Royal Oak, Michigan, killed 5 people, including himself, in the Royal Oaks post office. More recently, in 2017, a postal worker in Dublin, Ohio, arrived at the Dublin post office naked, then shot and killed his supervisor. Patrick Sherrill isn't alive today to tell us why he did what he did, but here is my opinion about him. I think Sherrill lived a disturbed and troubled life. His father's death as a teenager was traumatic for him, and he never seemed to fit in. As a teenager, he stood out. He was taller than anyone else and was losing his hair. He looked like a country boy among city kids. He was lazy and often did the bare minimum. In school, his grades were only good enough to graduate. In the army, he did what was required of him and nothing more. He was a loner who took advantage of his mother, and when she died, he resented getting a job and having to work to support himself. Whenever he was faced with a challenge or an inconvenience, he shut down. Instead of overcoming the challenge, he became angry and withdrawn. He resented people who asserted control or authority over him. He didn't like to be told what to do and when to do it. And when his supervisors confronted him about his poor job performance, he snapped. He considered himself to be one of the hardest working people there. So when he was told he wasn't, someone needed to pay. He was suicidal and showed a complete disregard for human life. He was irrational and impulsive. And on his last day of life, He wanted to take out as many people as possible. To put everything into perspective, violence at post offices remains incredibly rare. In the year 2000, a study on workplace violence was published. The study found that the homicide rates at postal facilities were lower than at other workplaces. The workplace that sees a much higher rate of violence is retail. And the homicide rate for postal workers was 0.22 per 100,000 versus 0.77 per 100,000 for workers in general. Mass shootings at post offices may be extremely rare, but they capture everyone's attention when they happen. If you or someone you know is in crisis, dial the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. The Suicide Crisis Lifeline at 988 provides 24/7 free and confidential support for people in distress. One more time, that's 988. Anatomy of a Massacre is a Rockefeller Audio production. If you like the show and would like to support it, there are a number of ways you can help. For a small monthly contribution, you can help create new compelling cases for the show, help fund research, and assist with production and editing costs. For supporting the show, you'll become one of the first to listen to new ad-free episodes and snag exclusive show merchandise not available anywhere else. To learn about how you can support the show, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/anatomyofamassacre, or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving a positive review. Sources for this episode include articles from Oklahoma History, Workplace Violence 911, The New York Times, and the FBI.